This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Welcome to another in the Exchange's 2016 Conversations with the Candidate series. I'm Laura Canoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our series continues today with 1st District Democratic candidate and former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. This hour, Josh and I will ask Ms. Shea Porter about some of the top issues in this race. We'll also present questions from our listeners received in advance on social media, and we'll hear from our audience here at NHPR, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. We're also streaming on Facebook Live, so welcome, everyone, and welcome, Carol Shea Porter.
Nice to see you, too.
Well, it's been a big headline all week, and not a flattering one for the Affordable Care Act. The Obama administration says premiums on the ACA's federal exchanges will go up an average of 25% next year. Republicans are saying this is one more reason why the ACA should be repealed. Before I ask you a couple questions on this, let's hear what you said in a debate earlier this week on NH1.
It is working. We need to fix it, and we need to make it stronger, but it is working, and it's here to stay.
So in that clip, again, you say, you know, we need to fix it, we need to make it stronger, but it's here to stay. Is there a fix for these rising premiums, or should Congress just start over?
Well, let's start off by saying that was there ever a time when premiums didn't rise when people had insurance and still have insurance that's not on the exchange? I mean, that's just, unfortunately, the cost of medical care does rise. We do know that the increase in medical costs has slowed down, but it is not time to start over. And after the Republicans have voted, who knows how many times at this point, to repeal it, they have never offered an alternative. So first I'd like to talk about what's really good about the ACA, and then we'll talk about ways to fix it. What's good about it is that it's given insurance to millions of people. In the state of New Hampshire, we now have 100,000 people, 50,000 in the ACA, and 50,000 people who have Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion is paid for by the authorized funding in the ACA. And for people who wonder what that means to them, I'll give an example. We've had a lot of low-income people who did not have health insurance, and now most of the state of New Hampshire does have access to health care. This has helped hospitals because they don't have to provide uncompensated care anymore. This has helped doctors. I spoke to many, many doctors who said that they're able to now treat the patient and make sure the patient receives what he or she needs because of that. It's helped people to get preventive care. It's helped women to have access and they're not being punished for pregnancy and being charged higher premiums. It's helped children to stay on their parents' policies until the age of 26. It's helped in Medicare. There's now free preventive exams. People didn't realize that if you were in Medicare, you didn't get a free physical. And it's also helped in a number of other ways. But what's important to note about this is that we are struggling right now with opioid and heroin addiction issues where the epicenter, New Hampshire, is. And 6,000 people have access to care because of that.
You know, as you were talking, it reminded me of what people said about Massachusetts when it first dove into this a decade or so ago, that the access issues, which you described, that worked, but the affordability is a tough one. A lot of people are saying the Affordable Care Act doesn't feel so affordable. So well, what fixes would you make if you were reelected?
Okay, well, it is affordable for people who are receiving subsidies. So we know, for example, that in the state of New Hampshire,
on the exchanges.
That's right. In the state of New Hampshire, about 70% of the people will not see an increase over $75, will not pay over $75 a month. The problem here is for those that fall in that gap, and it's not that many across the country, but if you're one of them, you know, it's devastating.
You're on the exchanges, but you don't get a
right.
subsidy.
Right. So that is definitely a problem there, and it has to be fixed. But in the state of New Hampshire, because we have four carriers, and for a number of other reasons as well, that they put Medicaid expansion people on the exchange and help grow it, put more numbers in there, they actually are going to see, as far as we know right now, an increase of only 2%. So New Hampshire's doing very, very well.
About the subsidies, and I have heard people say, well, these rates are going up, but, you know, people get subsidies, so they won't feel the pinch so much. But the issue of who pays, if rising premiums also means rising subsidies, how much more are taxpayers on the hook for this?
Well, I think what we have to ask ourselves is how much were taxpayers on the hook before? Because the insurance companies simply passed on the cost of treating people and the hospitals, et cetera, who had to treat people regardless of whether they had insurance or not. They would go to the emergency room or they wouldn't get treatment at all until they were very sick. A social worker sent me a booklet, and it was awful to look at, but I felt that I owed it to the family to look at. And they took pictures of their father every day for the last 2 weeks of his life. And what happened was he had no health insurance. And so he had pain in his abdomen, but he didn't go in for care or treatment. And then he wound up in the emergency room. And then they put him in hospice, and he died a few weeks later. And the social worker and the family wanted me to know what it meant to be able to get health care, you know, at the very end, and to make sure that other people had it as well. These are not unusual stories. I hear these stories all the time. And I just recently went to a community health center where they were talking about their ability to treat people and to treat more people because there's health care available for them now. And I went to a drug treatment center,
the
same thing.
Though? Yeah, and
right, we have to fix. Right, we have to fix.
Give us a specific, if you could,
please. Okay, well,
first,
if we would just stop talking about repealing and get them to work, you know, the Republicans to sit down and work with the Democrats to repeal, not repeal, but to fix it. Now, the first thing they could do, and we tried to do this, was there really should have been a public option there. So it would have been no frills and would have been able to compete. That would have held costs down.
Because Hillary Clinton's talking about that,
right,
now.
Because it is about competition. You know, we have to have some competition to help these insurance companies feel motivated to keep those costs down. There's other things that we can do as well. We should allow Medicare, for example, to negotiate the price of prescription drugs because that will put downward pressure on all of it. It is incredible, absolutely incredible, that the U.S. Congress passed a law in 2003 that said that Medicare cannot negotiate the price of prescription drugs. This is one of the runaway costs that we're seeing, you know, Big Pharma, and we're hearing many, many stories about that.
One last fix Hillary Clinton's been talking about in light of these cost increases is letting middle-aged people buy into Medicare. What do you think about that?
I think it's a really good idea. We know that Medicare holds your cost down between 3 and 7%. Insurance companies go, you know, way past that. So, and people know Medicare. Now, like every other program, and this includes the ACA, this includes everything, I think that we could do a much better job looking for waste, fraud, and inefficiencies. I think we always lag on that, making sure that after we put a good program in place that, you know, we hold everybody accountable and make sure that nobody's trying to, you know, get over and pull something over on the system. But I think it's a very good idea. People know what it is. It works. It's set up. And like I said, the costs are between 3 and 7%, the administrative costs.
Well, we could talk probably for another 20 minutes about healthcare, but I want to turn it over to my colleague, Josh Rogers. And go ahead, Josh, next question from you, please.
Good morning. A moment ago, you invoked Republicans in Congress and your hope that they would put aside their desire to repeal Obamacare and get to work. I want to refer you back to something you said in 2014 after you lost to Frank Ginta. You said you were concerned about the middle class because Republicans would now be running both houses of Congress. According to a recent Census Bureau report, the United States has had the biggest improvement in its poverty rate and incomes for some time. Do Republicans in Congress deserve any credit for this, or were they bystanders in your estimation?
Well, these programs were set into place, you know, before. I mean, this has been, we know what happened in 08 with the crash, the Wall Street crash, and the impact on Main Street and the families and the small businesses. So a lot of programs were put into place. So we were the ones that actually voted for more money for programs and to keep people in jobs, et cetera. So Republicans, let's start with, first of all, it's not true that everybody is at everybody's throat down there. Unfortunately, you know, it has not been very effective. I think it's as much the fact that under Speaker Ryan and Speaker Boehner, they don't show up very often. You know, we know they had 52 days off for the summer. They went back for a few weeks, and then they were missing again. So it's the reason that a lot of things don't happen. Yes, when you have compromise, and there is some compromise there, then I think both parties can take a bow. But I think if you want to take a look at what happens there, I think the funding for the Zika virus is a perfect example. Here was a public health challenge, and we know the harm that it's doing. And we also know that Puerto Rico and Florida and other areas are at high risk, and the women are at high risk, you know, for their baby's health. So they wanted to have some funding, emergency funding for Zika funding. And the House did pass a bill. It wasn't as much as it could have been, but they did pass a bill. The Senate rejected it, and then they said it was the fault of the Senate Democrats. What people don't know was what was in that bill for Zika funding. It wasn't just Zika funding. It was cutting Planned Parenthood, which would in particular hurt Puerto Rico, and also they want to allow Confederate flags to fly in veteran cemeteries. So if you want to get something through, if you want to be able to show, you know, real progress and actually address these issues, such as that public health issue, you can't be sticking other things that you know will absolutely not get by, because there's no way Senate Democrats were going to vote to repeal the ACA. There's no way that Senate Democrats were going to go, you know, reduce Planned Parenthood funding. And there's no way that Democrats were also going to say, sure, let's fly Confederate flags in VA cemeteries.
But as far as, that's the problem, obviously there. Both parties like to take credit for good economic news, and how much of good economic news can be directly attributable to, you know, political actors is a murky subject. But, I mean, do you think Republicans, they've been in the majority in Congress for the last couple of years, do they deserve any credit for economic gains that the country has had?
Well, I think, again, the policies were set into place early on by the Obama administration, and what we're seeing is this playing out. The reality is that so little legislation has actually passed, as you know, in the past 2 years, that it would be hard to say, you know, exactly where they would get credit, because there's been so darn little legislation, virtually none. But for those who voted and compromised, and there's compromise, there's always compromise there. For those who compromised on budgets and compromised on other issues, yes. Now, it's also important to note that they didn't pass a budget. So, you know, it can't be that they had a budget blueprint that actually worked, because they didn't pass a budget.
All right, let me turn to something specific, and this is an overtime rule that's about to kick in on December 1st, and that rule will require workers on salary who earn less than $47,000 a year to earn overtime pay if they work more than 40 hours a week. In New Hampshire, this change could affect 20% of salaried workers, and some businesses and nonprofits have worries they're not going to be able to afford it. Do you think these new rules are a good idea or not?
Well, I think they have to consider nonprofits. I started a nonprofit myself, so I understand, you know, the hours that people put in and what motivates them. They need pay as well. I would point out that they need fair pay. But the reason for this, I spent 4 years on what was then called the Education and Labor Committee, and the reason for that is that there were a lot of businesses, corporations that were paying for a 40-hour week and then demanding that they work 60, 70 hours a week. So there was a reason that this happened, to protect those workers and make sure that their salary, their base salary, actually wasn't so much lower because they were asked to work, you know, 60 hours a week.
But so it sounds like you'd be game to look at carve-outs for certain sectors of the economy, or?
Always when you are working on legislation, there has to be compromise, and you have to recognize that there are exceptions to the rule and that you have to do a carve-out to protect a certain group. But the more people are affected because they are wage earners and they're being paid salary, but they're actually working far more than the 40-hour work week. So I think, you know, it's a good idea. I support that. And we would have to look to make sure that we didn't inadvertently harm smaller nonprofits.
Let's take a question from our audience now. And a reminder that you can join us, too, with an email at exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at NHPR Exchange. Our guest today is 1st District Democratic candidate Carol Shea Porter, the former congresswoman running to regain the seat she lost 2 years ago. Again, we've got an audience here in Studio D at NHPR, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, and we have somebody at the microphone now. Go ahead. Thank you for being here. Give us your name and your question, please.
Thank you. My name is Angie. I'm from Holderness. Given that you intend to represent some of the communities that have been hardest hit by the opioid crisis, and given that 30-day recovery programs have proven to be ineffective as long-term solutions, how do you intend to effect a prevention-oriented change?
Thank you again for the question very much. And I also want to let you know that we got another question came in earlier this week that asks a similar question. This person says, why didn't Congress deal with the opioid crisis before? Were there any signs that it was going to get this bad? So to your question, thank you again.
Okay. So first, if you don't mind, I'd like to answer that part. Why didn't Congress do more? And I worked with Representative Kennedy, and we had a caucus. I was his vice chair, and it was the Addiction Recovery Treatment and Recovery Caucus. And we were working, trying to get Congress more aware and, you know, to educate the members and their staffers about this. And in 2010, I actually had my first bill trying to deal with this. And that bill was leading to some of what you're talking about. It was allowing and helping states to have places where they could drop off unwanted prescription drugs so that they wouldn't fall in the wrong hands, and also providing grant money for states and communities so they could do education programs, prevention programs.
And then, when was this again?
2010.
2010.
Right.
So a while ago.
Yes, I met with Colonel Quinn. He came, you know, he would come to the Hill and talk to people about these issues, and he was certainly pointing out that we were having a problem and the crisis was growing at that time. So that was one of the steps that I took. And then in 2013, 2014, we had a number of bills that would allow for, we wrote to FDA, for example, saying Narcan, you know, for overdose treatment, and calling for community treatment, et cetera. And we did try. But I think the timing wasn't quite there. I think a lot of people were not aware of it. But I certainly was, and a large number of my colleagues in Congress were aware of it. So for the prevention part, I said it's almost like we forgot. Every generation tells the two-year-olds, don't touch that hot stove, you can get burnt. And then when adolescents were smoking, and we had in adults, and we were having a very large-scale campaign telling people the damages that, you know, happen to your lungs and to your health if you smoke. And yet, we went quiet on, I think, too quiet on the risks of drug addiction, and we were not focusing on the opioids and the heroin. And what I hear a lot of people say is they didn't know before they first used any.
Opioid painkillers,
right,
for
right.
back pain
they
or
didn't
whatever.
Know, right. So we really fell down, you know, as a country, making sure that we had this. So we have to train doctors, because doctors are right there. The prescribers, they need to really, really tell people. I mean, I would recommend that they see a video before they ever get this, so that they have a strong sense of patient, a strong sense of what they're receiving. We have to go into the communities now, and we have to really make this a very, very intense public education program, continue to train people and peers to recognize the first signs of misuse of drugs. And so everybody is aware and watching. You know, the saying we have for the Homeland Security, see something, say something. I think we need to have the same thing where if we recognize that there's risk to people, that we're acting upon it. And then
sorry,
treatment
sorry to
programs.
Interrupt. Let me just let Josh jump in real quick.
Is there room for Congress to look at taking action against, you know, drug manufacturers for potentially misleading consumers? That's something that's going on at the state level. Attorney General Foster's looking into that. And Governor Hassan has said if she gets elected to the Senate, you know, she would support that sort of thing. Do you think there's a room for the House to take action on that?
I do. I think we need to look very closely. And, you know, I think we're just now realizing, and it should be studied, we should take a look on an oversight committee and see exactly what happened and make sure that if they played a role, and it appears that, you know, they did, that we go forward and determine what the appropriate
actions
are.
Sort of like the tobacco lawsuits of years back?
Well, it's not for me to say at this moment, because I think it would be unfair for me to say, you know, they need to be punished for this or for that. But I think the fact-finding is very important, and wherever that would lead.
Coming up, we'll turn to higher education, safe drinking water, the Iran nuclear deal. All that's coming up as our Conversations with the Candidate series continues on NHPR. Welcome back to our Conversations with the Candidates series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest is former 1st District Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter, who's running to regain the seat she lost in 2014. We're also taking questions from our audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, as well as those submitted in advance on social media. You can join us, too, by email, exchange at nhpr.org. NHPRExchange.org or on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at NHPR Exchange. And Josh, let's kick off this segment with a question from you.
Okay, I'd like to return to politics for a minute and your place among New Hampshire Democrats. Let's take a listen to how you described it yourself during a debate on NH1 this week.
When I first ran back in 2006, I was not the so-called chosen candidate, but I worked hard. I went around the district and I talked to people about what my agenda was and convinced them that I had the best vision for this country in representing New Hampshire. This time, I wasn't the choice for the National Democrats. I didn't let that stop me.
All right. That was you on NH1 this week. You say you're not the choice of National Democrats. I don't want to go back to 2006, but I do want to ask about this year. Is it right to assume you're referring to the hacked emails that showed people, National Democratic folks, leery of you running again and maybe hoping that Executive Counselor Chris Pappas might be recruited?
Right. Well, what I was talking about, since it's on WikiLeaks, it certainly wasn't any surprise to us, I have to say, because I do raise money in a different way, and probably, if not the only one, then it's got to be, you know, a handful of people there. That I don't take any corporate PAC money, and I don't take any lobbyist money. And in this day and age where fundraising is so critical because of the outside groups and the amount of money since Citizens United, you know, that they think you're weaker. And it is more of a challenge, I have to say. It is more of a challenge to run without that.
So to you, this was simply about a stance on fundraising?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, oh, I know it was. I know it was. We've had a number of conversations about this, you know, through the year. So, yeah, I feel pretty certain about that. But it doesn't mean that that's, I'm not offended. I think you just go out and you make your case. And I'm very proud that my colleagues, which is different from the DCCC, you know, the political arm, my colleagues have been incredibly supportive and they've been helping me. And I'm fielding a lot of phone calls right now, you know, cheering me on. So it's the work that you do ultimately that should be the reason that you're putting up with everything and running so hard, your ability to work with people and to make life better. So I'm comfortable with it. And, you know, people should not, you have to have a thick skin here. People should not run for office if they don't, because that's going to happen. There's that old saying that if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog.
Well, I mean, you bring up thick skin, and, you know, now there are three candidates in this race, and one is independent Sean O'Connor, and, you know, one could argue about the thickness of his hide this political season. I mean, he originally planned to run as a Democrat. He alleged that, you know, the fix was in among the Democratic establishment here. They wouldn't, you know, hear him out. He's now running as an independent, running as a Bernie Sanders supporter, basically. You know, Frank Ginta is hanging back and saying, you know, he feels like he's running in a Democratic primary where two candidates are trying to out-liberal each other. You know, we can make of that what we will, but you know, what is that circumstance like for you now?
Well, first of all, Sean is not running as, you have to keep up with this, Josh. Sean is not running as a Bernie-crat anymore. He's running as an independent and maybe a Republican independent. He was talking quite a Republican language, actually. So I don't think that's the case anymore. Of course, Frank would love to say that, but Frank sees the polling. He knows that actually, you know, it's people recognize that Sean O'Connor, even though he's polling very low, that he is pulling from the Republicans because he has aligned himself with them and indeed said he would caucus with them. So he's not...
I believe he said he'd caucus with...
The majority. Right. He'd caucus with the majority. And then so
you're not predicting a Democratic majority?
You know, I'm always hopeful, but because of the gerrymandering that was done, you know, after the 2010 election, we always hope. But right now, I think all of us could safely assume that it will be most likely a Republican majority. But things could change. Things certainly could change. But at the time when he said that, because of what's happening now, you know, with Donald Trump and the down ballot, by the time that he said that, it was pretty clear to most people that he was talking about that. And so
let's move on to higher education, very important issue to people here in New Hampshire. And in our interview 2 years ago, when we talked at the Rudman Center, you pointed to the work that you had done in Congress on student loans. Let's hear.
The other thing that we've done, and I did know I was proud of it, was I worked very hard to reduce the cost of college education, and we passed a very significant bill that took the middleman out, and so people could get their loans directly from the federal government and get a better deal doing that.
So here we are. New Hampshire college students still have the highest levels of debt in the nation, and both Republican nominee Donald Trump and Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren have asked, why is the government making a profit from student loans? How would you answer that?
Well, they shouldn't be. As simple as that. But when I was talking about taking the middleman out, what was happening at that time is the banks were receiving basically subsidies for handling the student loans. And so by taking the middleman out, we were able to put that money and put it into raising Pell Grants and putting more money available. And I was proud that I had an amendment that did increase the amount of Pell Grant money that people received. So, you know, the interest rates right now are about 3.76 or whatever on the loans that are subsidized. But the problem is that college is too expensive.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Tech school is too expensive. Those costs have been going up. We did try to take a number of steps that would hold the cost down. You know, we tried to do some things with textbooks. And one of the issues, we tried to go after the for-profit schools that were taking a lot of money and not delivering. And so, you know, there have been efforts made. I was on, as I said, the education, and at the time it was called Labor Committee, now it's Workforce. And we were trying to target this, and we had some success, and I'm proud of that. But obviously, this is incredibly difficult. I put myself through college working in factories, and I know how hard it is for students. They need to be able to come out if their families don't have, you know, high income levels. They need to be able to come out of school debt-free.
Well, clearly, even with efforts like the Pell Grants, like the loans, debt is a serious issue for many students in New Hampshire. Another higher education question for you, please. Hillary Clinton has said in this campaign she wants to make public colleges tuition-free for students from families making under $125,000 a year. That is estimated to cost more than $500 billion over the next decade. Mrs. Clinton says it can be paid for by raising taxes on the wealthy. Do you think this is the way to go?
Well, there's a number of ways to increase the income there. And I think, yes, we do need to make it possible. Now, she did say that the students need to work, and I think that's important. Nothing should be handed for free. They have to have some skin in the game as well. So it's important that they work, you know, while they study. I know you can do it. I did. But they should not come out with $100,000 or $50,000, or in New Hampshire for undergrad, I think it's about $37,000 from the University of New Hampshire. That's outrageous. How do you get up out of bed every morning when you have a job from, you've gotten a college degree or tech degree, and you're earning and starting $30,000 or $35,000, and you know you already owe every penny that you're going to earn? And that's just not right. But there are ways to increase money. We need to take away subsidies from oil companies, a mature industry, and we're giving them subsidies. We need to go after multinational companies, American companies, that take their IP address and they move it to places like Ireland.
And so this is a good idea.
Yeah, tens of billions of dollars we lose every year on that. That's amazing. Jeffrey Sachs reported that, and that's an
He's
enormous...
He's an economist from Harvard,
yes,
I think.
Yeah,
so
enormous.
This $500 billion, though, I mean, that's a big new entitlement program. Is that something the United States really can afford at this point?
Well, let's ask ourselves how every other country is able to afford to do that. Every other country that is, you know, considered world leaders, and we are not able to assist our young people. When they're educated, remember, education is the key to prosperity in this country. When they're educated, when we educate young people, then they can compete in a world market. And they have all kinds of brilliant ideas and energy and dreams, but they're held back if they don't have access to school.
One more question for you on this, and I want to turn it back to Josh. What incentive would public colleges have to be thrifty, to constrain those costs, as you mentioned, if, for most students, federal taxpayers are now footing the bill? Could they just say, great, let's just keep raising tuition because the feds will cover it?
Well, I think that you couldn't just do one without the other. Obviously, there has to be some accountability. And when I talk about things, I think people hear me say very often about needing the accountability, needing the ways to check. When I spent 6 years on the Armed Services Committee, and I kept saying, why aren't we hiring more watchdogs to watch and actually when we get a report, don't just put it on the shelf, you know, actually do something. And this really is across the government. I really want to see us go after the waste, fraud, and inefficiency. And I think that's something Republicans and Democrats absolutely agree on, that there is too much waste and fraud and inefficiency. However, when these big bills come before Congress and everybody's got their nut hidden somewhere in that pile there, you know, that's when the
that's the sausage being made.
That's when they break down on their will to do something about
it. Well, and to get our audience back into this, here's an email that came in to me yesterday from Derry. Emailer is named Jerry, who says, I have voted for you in the past because you are honest and you support many of my passions. But Jerry asks, why is it even fair that our representatives in Congress decide on your own salary and benefits? Also, what is your position on term limits? And Jerry, I want to thank you for that email. Go ahead.
Yeah, and thank you, Jerry, for your past support. And I hope my answer convinces you to do it again. So I think we'll do the two-part question
again. The first one is, why do representatives in Congress get to decide their own salaries and benefits?
Okay, that's the first one I'd like to address. Actually, they haven't raised it since 2008. And I think that's a good idea, you know, that it has stayed there. We do pay Social Security. I think a lot of people don't realize that members of Congress pay Social Security. Didn't used to be, and then they changed the law, and they should pay Social Security. And they do pay for medical, which is important as well. So they pay Social Security, they pay medical, and their salary has been frozen since 2008, which is reasonable. The term limit part, I think, you know, that's like big government coming in and telling voters what their choices are going to be. And I don't believe in that because voters get to make that choice. In the state of New Hampshire, anybody can run for a congressional seat. Anybody. The party does not choose you, contrary to what some people say. You can walk into the Secretary of State's office, put down $50, and you are running for Congress.
Well, and in your seat in the first district, you and Frank Ginta basically term limited each other for the last, I don't know, decade
right.
or so, but we'll talk about that later.
But this is one of the good things, that in a district like this one, that's only, 26% Democratic, 34% Republican, there's 8 points that the Republicans have, but those independents are 40%.
Well, let me turn this back to Josh. Go ahead.
All right, let's turn to drinking water in District 1. Residents in and around Merrimack are very worried about high levels of the chemical PFOA in their water. It's linked to cancer, among other things. A St. Gobain plastics plant in the area is blamed for this. And some also point their fingers, though, at Congress for blocking regulations that might have allowed investigation of the health risks of PFOA. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think any criticism that's leveled at Congress for not protecting our clean water and air is absolutely warranted. And this comes from the result of so many of these outside groups. We need campaign finance reform to keep these groups out so that they can't send their lobbies and they can't get their bills passed. There has been, and it's no secret, I mean, just look at climate change, where we have, I spent 4 years on the Natural Resources Committee, so I know the battles that go on about water, the battles that go on about land, the battles that go on about air quality. And it's outrageous that Congress has dragged its feet, accepted money from these groups, and then made it more difficult for you know, people to have clean water, clean air, and to be able to do something about climate change.
So you'd be supportive. My understanding is that there are protections in the law that allow businesses to hide the nature of their chemicals under sort of a trade secrets sort of provision. Is that something that you would look to undo potentially?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've tried to force this, you know, the battle in the Natural Resources Committee, I'm sure, is raging on, you know, even as for as long as I can remember, they have fought over these issues. So, yes, I think we do need to make sure that we know what they're using. People have a right. I mean, this is people have a right to clean water, clean air. They have a right to assume that their child's lungs won't be, you know, assailed every day because people in Congress said no to cleaning up air or said no to protecting water or disclosing chemicals.
Michelle Porter, I want to switch gears and turn to foreign policy and specifically the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran. This has been a big issue in many of our New Hampshire campaigns this year. Since signing the deal, Iran has expanded its regional influence, has worked to counter American interests in Syria, for instance. And then this week we learned that an Iranian-American citizen who was visiting family in Iran, was sentenced to 18 years in prison for, quote, collaborating with a hostile government. This doesn't sound very good.
Well, nobody said that Iran is a good government. I mean, they're an awful government. That's the reason that they put this in, because they had to put some checkpoints in Iran. Iran was on its way to developing one. And so what this did was it put a lot of, we use sanctions, as
you
know.
You're talking about the deal.
Yes, and I supported sanctions. You know, I thought that was good, but we needed to do more, obviously. And the countries in the region supported this as well, and they have
Except
people,
Israel. Well, does not support this.
But that's right. But they have people on the ground. It's a 24/7 access. And really, when you consider that they're bad actors in a very dangerous environment, you know, that I did absolutely support it. Now, does this make Iran, like, reasonable? No. Does it make them trustworthy? No. That's why they have people on the ground 24/7 that can have access to see. And everything can be undone. Everything. There's nothing in this that they have to continue. If they violate it, it can be undone. But Iran is not known for protecting human rights. It's not known for being honest. It's not known for any of those things. That's why we have to be very, very vigilant.
So this Iranian-American citizen is just the latest of several other dual citizenship people who've been jailed in a secret trial in Iran. What kind of leverage does the U.S. have now to help these folks out now that the deal is signed?
Well, they could cancel the deal. See, if they violate the provisions there, and that's what I was saying, that this could be canceled at any point there. But this is why it's so difficult now, and this is why we need a very strong diplomatic corps, and we need public outrage, and we need free press to be able to report this. Because all around the world, not just Iran, all around the world, there's terrible human rights violations, and there's abuse. We know this. Look at Syria. It's heartbreaking. China, you know, and we could name many places. And the United States has to work with partners who are like-minded to change this. And I think the role of the United Nations is important, et cetera. But we are not able, unless we are going to say each time we're sending troops in, which we're not able to do, we are not able to change every single wrong that is done. But we are able to talk about this, to put pressure on them, to put sanctions where we can and when we must do
can
this.
Can we sanction Iran given
this deal? Well, we
have
sanctioned
Iran. Confers certain benefits on them.
We have sanctioned Iran. And like I said, all of this can be undone by any proof that they have violated this. But the most important part to me are that inspectors are on the ground 24/7 with access, whether Iran wants them to have access or not.
If one of these families were from New Hampshire and they called you and you got reelected and they said, Congresswoman, help me out. My son is stuck in an Iranian prison. I mean, what would you say to that person?
We've had those happen before. And, you know, it's very tragic. It's heartbreaking. And the thing that has to be done is, again, we have to use every tool that we have at our disposal, but that doesn't mean our troops. It means, you know, the tools at our disposal, which is diplomacy, which is threatening of economic sanctions, which is, you know, a number of ways to make them feel the pain there.
A serious topic, and I'm sorry to jump in on you there. More in a moment. Welcome back to our Conversations with the Candidate series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest is former Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter of the 1st District. She's running to regain the seat she lost 2 years ago. We talked with the current Congressman, Frank Ginta, last week. This hour, we're taking questions from our live audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, as well as those submitted in advance on social media. And Josh, let's start off with a question from you, please.
Sure. I'd like to ask about abortion. This year's Democratic Party platform calls for the repeal of the Hyde Amendment, which has been in place for 40 years, which bars use of federal money to perform abortions, with exceptions in the cases of rape, incest, or the health of the mother. Do you support that repeal?
Well, when we're looking at low-income women who are unable to access the same health care as women and men who are of higher income, then we have to ask ourselves, is this being fair, the way that we approach this? So this is a really difficult topic because most people for themselves would not choose and say and have said that for themselves they wouldn't. But they believe that everybody should have the choice to decide, you know, what's right for them or after, you know, consulting with their doctor and themselves and whatever people need to do in their lives. I think that we need to respect that and we need to make sure that they have the option to do that. But I feel that what we're looking at now is so divisive, where we have a Congress now that's blocking access to contraception, that doesn't want to pay for Planned Parenthood for access to, you know, regular breast cancer exams and all kinds of medical exams and obviously birth control to prevent pregnancies. So I feel that most of us feel that we're under assault in terms of the choices that we are able to make and the right to make the decisions for ourselves. So
I mean, the Hyde Amendment has been in place. I mean, some have referred to it as sort of a kind of a detente on, you know, to some degree on the question of abortion. It sounds like you're saying, given the climate, it's worth undoing that?
Given the climate, I don't even think that could happen right now. I think the issue right now is to make sure that women and men, because, you know, there are two people involved here, have the right to make their decisions. I'm very concerned about the attempt to roll back Planned Parenthood, access to health care, and the assault on women. The choices when women decide that that's what's best for them or their physicians advise them that's what's best for them, they are putting them through extra steps like, you know, that awful thing where Governor Pence said that there should be funerals for fetuses regardless of whether it's a miscarriage or not. The ultrasounds, the vaginal, ultra-vaginal, whatever they call it, sounds there, it's outrageous.
But it sounds like you say that you don't believe that the Hyde Amendment would likely be repealed. So, I mean, as a matter of principle, you think that it's important to have that debate?
I don't think it's going to be repealed right now. You know, I am under great concerns here that women aren't even going to have the access that they've had to birth control and to abortion at all. So I think that while that is something that can come to the table in a year or two after we decide who's president and we affirm that Roe versus Wade is, you know, a law that has to stay in this land, I think we've got unbelievable pressure from these various state governments, that actually the Republicans and across the states, the governors who are trying to strip access to reproductive health care for women. So our challenges in front of us right now are enormous to just hold where we are and to make sure that we don't lose, you know, the right to make our own decisions.
Let's turn to immigration. And you've said, Ms. Shea Porta, that the current immigration system, quote, leaves millions of undocumented workers living in the shadows. What type of change would you vote for if you're sent back to Congress when it comes to immigration? For example, if you bring those people out of the shadows, then what happens?
Well, that's why I support, and you know that Republicans and Democrats is something that they couldn't, you know, get through the House, but I support comprehensive immigration reform because we can't do anything while people are in the shadows. And we know that there's 11 million or so, 12 million maybe.
How do you bring them out then?
Living there. Well, first of all, you have to have a program, a way to bring them to citizenship. And, you know, 5 years here and working and learning English and paying a fine and, you know, education. So there's a number of steps that they should have to go through, but to just push them aside is wrong, first of all, and to break up these families. There are so many.
So don't deport them.
No, there are so many children.
Put those requirements on, but don't deport them.
Right. For those that have been here and are settled here, no, we have to protect our borders. We have to do a better job protecting our borders. I think our borders are still need, you know, more security there. But for those who are here and they have families here, I think what we need to do is comprehensive immigration reform instead of pretending they're not. And the other part that we have to do, which slows down the number of people who tried to come here, is to actually prosecute employers because
you have said that.
I've said
employers
it,
who
right.
knowingly hire ineligible
they only hire
workers
them,
should
they pay
be held
them lower wages
accountable.
And they, right.
Yeah. So how would you go about that? You know, and what would happen to those workers whose illegal status was uncovered as a part of that process of holding their bosses liable?
Well,
so let's say you bust up a company.
And they tell them,
there's
right.
30 people working there illegally. What happens to the company and what happens to those workers?
Well,
this is terrifying for them.
Yes, it is. And we've seen these raids, which is absolutely terrifying for people. And that's why we need to have the comprehensive reform so that we have a system, and we would have to set up, you know, the infrastructure to do all this. But it's not doesn't require infrastructure to prosecute the heads of companies who have deliberately brought them. I mean, these laws are in place.
I mean, you mentioned comprehensive immigration reform several times, and obviously that stalled, you know, largely due to fighting within the Republican Party. But Republicans who have favored so-called comprehensive immigration reform, a lot of them now say the first thing we need to do is secure the border. Once that happens, we can have a discussion that might be more fruitful. Is that a view you share? I mean, do you think that that will be a necessary precondition for anything to move through Congress?
To secure the border first?
Yes.
Well, why can't we do both at the same time? I mean, I think we're a great country. We're capable of doing both at the same time. I was reading an interesting article in the New York Times, I think it was this summer, and they were asking the ranchers about building the wall. And they said that they didn't feel that the wall would help them, you know, where they were living. But what they wanted were more foot patrols. I completely agree, and that would have been in the comprehensive reform. You know, far more foot patrols, more people there. We need to use the technology that's available now. You know, there's all kinds of technology to detect. And finally, we need to do a better job at the checkpoint of entry where they come through. A lot of the, or most of the drugs, actually, the opioids and heroin's coming through, right, going through the checkpoint because we're not checking all of the cargo that's passing through. So there's a lot that we can do right now. We don't have to wait for something to pass or wait for all this to happen. We could do this simultaneously.
Ms. Shaport, have you talked to illegal immigrants here in New Hampshire working at, you know, restaurants in Manchester or factories in Rochester? Have you met or talked to them?
I never ask them, you know, if they're like waitressing or whatever. It's not for me to ask, just as I wouldn't expect them to ask me, are you a citizen? You know, that's not a question that I would ask. I would have to assume that every company is doing due diligence. But I have talked to people who are here legally, and I have met people who are here, you know, undocumented, and when I was in Congress, and they would, you know, talk to all the members of Congress about their plight and you know, being divided by families, et cetera. So, yes, I know their stories, and they're painful stories. They really are.
Well, here's a question that came in on social media. It just came in yesterday, and I want to thank this person for submitting his or her question. What role do you see the federal government playing in addressing the issue of climate change? And again, thanks for the question.
Well, the federal government has to address this thing. We've been talking about climate change and the negative impact and the danger, and we have certainly seen the climate change. You know, I think we made a mistake when we first called it climate warming or global warming, because actually we now know that climate change manifests itself in cold and wet and rain and hurricanes and hot weather and many other ways. But we know
our winter last year and a crazy winter the winter before.
We know our sea levels are rising. We know that along our own coast we're seeing that. If you talk to any farmers or anybody who relies on winter tourism, they can tell you the changes that they have seen. So yes, the federal government absolutely does, because it's the federal government that we need to cut down on dirty polluters. We need to switch over to green energy. We know that that's working. The cost of solar has dropped about 70%. We know that I think Germany uses about 30% green energy now. So we need to do this for our economic security so that we have a steady supply of energy we can count on. We need to do it for national security because we find ourselves in very tough places and, you know, putting our troops at risk. And we need to do it because we need to save the planet, basically.
Would you support a carbon tax if you were reelected?
Would I support a carbon tax? Yes.
Because some environmentalists say that's really the way to go.
Yes, I would. And I think that when we look at all of this, we recognize that that it has to be several pronged effort here. We have to reduce the carbon. So, you know, that obviously is a good way. We have to provide subsidies for companies that are investing in energy, renewable energy. And we also need to make sure that we are still using that thing that we understand from our Yankee upbringing, which is conservation, conserve energy.
All right.
Producing green energy, reducing dirty energy, and conserving.
I want to turn it back to Josh Rogers then. Go ahead, Josh.
Okay, I want to ask a couple of political questions. And you're obviously a big supporter of Hillary Clinton, have been for some time. But obviously Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary by a large margin here. And a lot of the themes in his campaign sounds like what you've been talking about for years. I often thought that covering his events when he referred to, you know, essentially the rest of us kind of rhetoric. You know, why weren't you supporting him?
Well, I liked what Bernie said, you know, and I think he's reminded us of the urgency of now, that a lot of the problems have become chronic, you know, low wages, unfair wages, are absolutely true. And I think he diagnosed the problem with the middle class and the poor in this country accurately. So I did support, you know, his ideas and what he said. I supported Hillary Clinton because I think she had a vast experience around the world. Spent 6 years on the Armed Services Committee. I was a military spouse, and I felt that she knew that world map better than anybody else, and that she was ready on day one. And I supported her for her agenda. I thought it was incredibly well developed, and that she knew her way around.
I mean, I think
but
a lot of
Bernie
people
would have been you know, good as well. I was proud that we had that caliber of candidate. We had two candidates.
I mean, a lot of people.
We had three, actually, very good ones. But
I mean, a lot of people talk about how Bernie Sanders helped create a more liberal Democratic platform and move the party to the left, force Secretary Clinton to change some of her positions. Do you believe that that mood within the Democratic Party is going to stick, after the election's over?
Well, first let me say that I received the endorsement of almost everybody on the Bernie Steering Committee, I think all but two. And so I'm proud of that. It shows a shared interest. But what Bernie's agenda is and what Hillary's agenda is, and they have worked together, you know, for that platform, is really for the middle class, for Main Street in this country. So it's a progressive agenda in the sense that it moves this country, we make progress, we move forward. But it's really about making sure that we turn to the families. We know families are struggling because child care is too expensive. We know they're struggling because their wages are too low. We know they're struggling because they've got school debt and it's hard for them, you know, to save any money. We know it's difficult for seniors. What we're talking about is quality of life, opportunity, and fairness. And that is what is in that agenda. And that is what we saw Bernie talking about. And obviously, people identified with that. They knew that was true. That when you talk about that, how difficult it is for families to get by now. And I've been running and have said repeatedly that I'm running to restore the American dream. And I tell people, you know, that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And what was happening here.
I've not heard that before.
What was happening here was that the middle class has been on, and small businesses have been on the menu in Washington for too long.
What
All right,
does that mean?
We've only got a minute or two left. But, you know, we spoke to Congressman Ginta last week, and I posed a similar question to him, that it's become almost an autumn ritual. The leaves fall, days get shorter, and you know every 2 years in the first district, it's Shea Porter or Ginta. Do you ever feel like you're trapped in some sort of political corn maze with him?
I think we reflect what's happening in Washington, don't you? Where there's a clash of ideas, and it's not just Washington, by the way. It's New Hampshire, and it's every other state. That's why you see every election so close now, because Americans are looking very closely, and I respect the process of saying what and who will best help my family. Now, for me, you know, Frank Ginta has the advantage that because this district is more Republican than Democratic. I indicated 26% Democratic, so if I got every Democrat out, I still can't win.
I mean, it's been good to you in presidential years.
Right, because independents come out, and independents come out in much larger number in presidential years, and they obviously lean Democratic. So they hear our message of inclusiveness, our message about restoring the American dream, our message about making sure that families have opportunity, that we hear them and understand them, that we're working on these issues. So I think when they show up in those larger numbers and they hear the differences in the platforms there, that they do choose the Democrats. And I feel very honored when I am chosen, and when I'm not, I know that, you know, the voters have spoken, and the deal is that you get up, brush yourself off, and say, let me get back to work, because there's so much work to be done to move this country forward.
So you're not sick and tired of him yet?
Running. You know what? Let me say that here's the thing. Every person can put $50 down and run for Congress. And then they go through a primary. And when the voters chose Frank Ginta, even though it was 670 votes, he won his primary.
In the primary.
Right. I have to respect that. He won his primary. In my primary, you know, the person who thought he was a Democrat decided he wasn't a Democrat, didn't put his $50 down, didn't run. And so, you know, but clearing a field, when people talk about clearing a field, it's always up to an individual to assess how strong is this candidate. So I think people looked and said, you know, I'm a strong candidate. I've been true. I've been honest. People know who I am. You can pick up my 06 campaign literature. It says the same thing, fighting for the middle class, now, forever, and always.
All right, we will close it out there. That wraps it up for our conversation with 1st District Democratic candidate and former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. Thanks to our listeners who submitted questions, to our live audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. Thanks to my colleague Josh Rogers, and again to our guest, former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.